Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We are joined by a very special guest here with us today. We are here to talk about a new book called Sound, a memoir of hearing, lost, and found by Bella Bathurst. Bella is here with us somewhere in the UK on her cell phone. Bella, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Bella, I mean, first of all, congratulations on the book. What a marvelous read. What a beautiful and poetic piece about the extraordinary. Is that fair for me to say?
Well, it's very kind of you to say so. Yes, I guess it was sort of, I mean, it's nice to hear that it's poetic. I hope it's also kind of, you know, telling a good story as well.
So speaking of story, why don't I'm going to read the quote for our listeners right off the front cover. Quote, a moving and fascinating book about sound and what it means to be human, close quote. That was the Financial Times, and I'm not sure who the writer was there, but this idea of being human and listening and sound, and I mean, you just have some and I think that's what I mean about being poetic to some degree, is that your observations, the things that you seem to pay attention to, you know, or were almost pushed into paying attention to, I think is really fascinating for a variety of reasons. But I wonder if you could just sort of start us off a little bit by, you know, with your story. You know, there's an accident, you know, that you sort of make some, you know, causal connections to and so on. So, yeah, if you could you just give us an overview of where this book came from, because you're more of a you write fiction.
So I guess it all started. I was about 27, and so actually, when I'd been at university, that I'd had one head injury, a skiing injury, and then about 7 years later, I turned it was a pickup truck actually, over on black ice. And after that, I started to go deaf fairly rapidly. And at the time, I was sort of diagnosed with I'd already lost half my hearing in both ears, and they just kind of said, okay, here's some hearing aids. We think you've got sensory neural damage. this is what you need to get on with it, and you're pretty much just left to it. And I'm sure anyone who's had a hearing loss diagnosis has probably had the same experience. Here's some hearing aids and get on with it, kind of thing. And so that was it for the next 12 years. I did swap over to some slightly more sophisticated digital hearing aids, but it wasn't until I was retested in a different way in about 2009 that it was discovered that I didn't have that type of hearing damage. It had nothing to do with those head injuries. It was a genetic condition called otosclerosis, which is one of the very, very few operable hearing conditions. So I went and had each ear operated on, one at a time with a year apart, and I got my hearing back. And after that, I've always been a writer and journalist, but I'd never, up until that point, written anything about hearing or deafness or how it had affected me. And to be honest, for about a good 7 years, actually, after I got my hearing back in both ears, I kind of went, okay, I'm not going to touch this. I just want to get as far away from the experience as I possibly can. And it wasn't until I'd sort of processed it and had some distance on it that I wrote about it. But I didn't want it just to be about my own experience, because my experience of deafness was such that there was very little else written about it. And I kept coming across, you know, thousands and thousands of people who...
Well, don't you talk at one point in the book about up to 11 million people suffering from some kind of hearing loss or another in the UK?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the same for pretty much any developed country. So the US is pretty much the same, about a fifth of the population, and Canada the same. So it's a huge, huge number of the population, and it's just not written about, not talked about. You have any other condition, and you know, you think about cancer, and there are reams of books on cancer. There's personal accounts, or there's kind of medical guides, or kind of whatever it is. But deafness, I mean, there's some stuff about kind of sign language, but for those who have lost their hearing as opposed to those who were born profoundly deaf, there really, really isn't that much. Hearing loss is not a... Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So just wondering about, there's so many questions I have for you, and I want to talk about, you know, things around the technology and about the diagnosis and so on. But do you think, and this is my philosophical background coming out here, freedom, determinism. Do you think life sort of deals us these things sometimes to, I don't know, to allow us to make new choices, to provide other opportunities. I mean, I just love how you took what could have been and probably was for you, as it comes out in the book in a variety of ways, a very difficult experience, and you've turned it into this, you know, beautiful gift, I hope, for yourself, but also for others, you know, and you've provided this opportunity. I mean, chapter 13, your last chapter is just, everyone needs to read chapter 13. It's remarkable. And I'm gonna read from it later. But the way you're recognizing this beauty all around us, and then kind of offering us this gentle corrective, I think. Anyway, there's a few questions wrapped up in that. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that. Oh, I don't know, that new opportunity that was presented to you.
Yeah, I guess at the time, I mean, when I got the initial diagnosis, it was a sort of, you know, it was about 10 minutes when it was a novelty, and then I really lost my sense of humor about it.
And
got going. I mean, it's like the, you know, the stages of grief. I spent a long time on the pissed off stage. And
I think I would too, Bella. That's, I think, where I'd spend a fair bit of time as well.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of get stuck on that one. So, I mean, I stuck with the really annoyed stage for quite a while. And then, I guess, I mean, but part of my problem at the time was, I was 27, 28. There was nobody in my friendship group, my family, you know, around me, my colleagues, my peers, who was deaf. I mean, there were some old people, there were some sort of grannies and that sort of thing, but there was nobody whose experience I could directly relate to, who I could go to and say, look, I'm losing my hearing. It's not, you know, everybody keeps making a joke about it, and I keep making a joke about it, but actually it's really not funny, and some of the consequences are really big. So I think I didn't know sort of how to pitch it, how to handle it. So I think it took me a long time to find a route through, because I really had to make that route up as I went along, because there just wasn't anyone, you know, there wasn't anybody else to take my cue from. So I think in some ways that was very useful. It was just kind of, okay, you're on your own with this, but there's certain things you can definitely do to make this easier. And also, it is that old thing, it's almost a cliche, your other senses do come up to fill the gap.
Right, yeah. I did want to ask you about that. It's almost as if the volume, ironically, is turned up on those senses.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you really do notice it. And, I mean, I amplified that by going to work in a pro photographic lab. So I was processing, at that stage it was film, I was processing and contacting old-fashioned film. And so I was looking at images day in, day out, and that as a visual education was incredibly powerful. And I started noticing that it was sort of building up my visual sense, my visual language, and then I started noticing that I was just that much more interested in interpreting and looking at the way people, all the stuff that's outside speech, all the body language, all of that, and that started to make a really big difference as well. I mean, they always say that a huge amount of human communication is out with speech. It's you know, what we actually communicate in words is only a quarter. It's
sure.
That of,
yeah, the non-verbal sort of almost takes precedence, and yet we don't seem to put as much or pay as much attention to it.
Absolutely. So I learned to prioritize the non-verbal, and that's wonderful. That's a wonderful skill to learn, and also this. I mean, I now do a sort of daily thing on Twitter of great sounds. You know, whether it's you know, sharpening a pencil or the kettle boiling or kind of whatever it is.
That's so cool. I love it.
Tiny, tiny great sounds, because they are beautiful, and we think about in terms of music or speech, but we don't think in terms of how gorgeous, how amazing, how cool sound is, because we spend so much time, actually trying to get rid of, you know, if you live in London or a big city, there's endless announcements, there's kind of huge amounts of sort of white noise, there's music, there's stuff you really don't want to hear. So there's lots of stuff you don't want to hear, but you don't think of all the stuff that is just gorgeous. You know, there's a crackle of winter bonfires, or the different right. sounds that snow makes, or kind of whatever it is.
It's I want to go back to the comment about, you know, our other senses get heightened. Do you think? I mean, physiologically, I wouldn't think they're actually turned up. It's just that you now have more resources to apply to them? Because I think you do talk about that a little bit in the book, but or is it that you've been pushed, you know, into this situation where you have to pay attention? You've got one less tool over here, so I've got to sharpen these other, you know, this other set of knives in my, you know, in my physiological toolbox. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's a really interesting one. I think neurologically, it would be really interesting to test somebody who was losing one of their senses and see if actually there was more activity in the other senses, in the regions of the other senses. I mean, obviously that didn't happen with me, but it did feel as if that sense, that visual sense in particular, was tuning up. But I also got this kind of weird phenomenon where I would start getting kind of phantom smells as well.
Right, interesting.
Which was really strange. So I'd sort of come downstairs in the middle of a weekday and you know, I could smell a Sunday roast, or the smell of patchouli, or the smell of spring flowers, or kind of whatever, completely wrong time of year. And it was just, it was really weird. It was like my senses were sort of trying to tune up, or trying to, you know, they were sort of testing kind of thing.
Were the phantom smells, were they always pleasant? Were they always connected to sort of fond memories as well? Or did you ever smell, like, I don't know, diesel fume?
Yeah, absolutely. I did smell diesel fume. And diesel fume in particular, actually, since you mentioned it, because diesel fume was the smell of the car accident. So
right.
there were some that were very associative, and then there were some that were just utterly random, as I say. I mean, smells connected with the wrong time of year, so the smell of hay or something in the middle of the city in December kind of thing. So they were lovely smells, but they were just sort of in the wrong
right,
place.
Right. So you're going to, I hope you laugh out loud, and I hope this brings a smile to every listener out there once we're up live and online. But my family just got a dog recently. Sasha's her name. She's from Greece, actually. So she doesn't speak a whole lot of English. She's in my office right now, and I can hear her through my headphones, and she's snoring. And I thought, you know, if she's just sitting here, she's not going to bother us. She doesn't really bark. So I was worried about, oh boy, we're going to get interrupted. But I can't help but just delight in this beautiful little a serendipitous moment of this rumble of her in the background, wondering if it's going to be caught on digital while you and I are having our interview and conversation. I think it's quite lovely.
That would be really lovely. I like this kind of snoring in the background.
It's so funny, right? I mean, just think about all the sounds dogs make, you know, and it's just, it really makes me smile. It's just, we, you know, and I think that's the question. I think that's where I was going with, you know, around the question about our other senses being heightened. And I think, you know, this idea of wonder, this idea of paying attention and listening. I mean, I so love your chapter on listening and about this. You talk about it being an act of communion, and I hope in a few minutes we can talk about taxi drivers and Tony Parker and what crisis listening is all about, because I'd really love to spend some time on that. But in an earlier part of the book, you say that until the car, it's at the beginning of chapter 3, you say, until I turned, quote, the car upside down, I had been just like everyone else. I accepted the ordinary miracle of my senses, and I expected them to get on with the job. I mean, are you kind of making a comment here, would you say, about everything we take for granted, or in this case, that maybe you were taking for granted? Is that sort of where you were going with that?
Yeah, totally. I mean, yes. I mean, I think we all do it. We wake up in the morning and we absolutely rely without even thinking about it, on our five senses and the correct functioning of, you know, the our hands, our feet, our legs, our kind of whatever. And it isn't until one of those malfunctions, or there's a pain somewhere, or kind of whatever it is, that you actually kind of think, oh my God, this is just extraordinary. If you actually look at the mechanism of human vision or human hearing, it is miraculous. I mean, beyond...
Right. It's true.
I mean, it's so complex and so beautiful. And, I mean, you know, forget Fabergé eggs. What we have inside fitted as standard is absolutely... Yeah, a miracle is the only word.
Is it okay that I don't know what a Fabergé egg is?
Yeah, for sure, it's fine.
I'm assuming it's like some sort of, is it like some sort of product or something that you can buy?
It'll take a bit of a long time to explain.
Right.
It was beautiful. There were amazing jewels that were made for the Russian Tsar.
Of course, you know what?
Extraordinarily talented jeweler.
I do.
Sometime in the 19th century.
So you know, you realize that 30% of our listeners right now are Googling that, right? It's for sure happening. Tell me a little bit about your sort of, you know, you talk about this act of communion around listening. So you talked about also about sort of being on your own after that first 10 minutes of, you know, just, you know, sort of when the news really started to sink in. What about community? What about the people around you? Were you supported? Did you feel ostracized? What can you tell me about that stigma around how I might, you know, if you and I had met and we shook hands at a party and I found out either by somebody telling me or by through conversation that you were deaf, would I be treating you now differently as you know because of your deafness? Can you offer some insights into some of those things?
Well, I mean, for sure, I didn't make life easy on myself. So for about 3 or 4 years after I was initially diagnosed, I just didn't tell people that I had a hearing loss. So.
Right.
So I didn't tell people that I really couldn't hear well. So if I met somebody new, as I did because of my job all the time, I wouldn't say, look, I can't hear very well. I've got hearing aids, but it really helps if you just speak up a bit, don't hide your mouth and keep turned towards me. I would just kind of, you know, sort of, I mean, I've always worn my hair long, so I would cover the hearing aids. Nobody could see them. And so what might happen if I met you for the first time was actually you would probably think I was really rude because I might just, you might say something and because I wouldn't hear,
right.
I would turn away mid-sentence. And that was very, so I think there was a lot of people who I totally involuntarily blanked. I didn't realize I was blanking them because they'd said something to me and I just didn't respond. So they ended up thinking I was rude, and that I find really, really, really difficult to deal with. And I also found it difficult because, you know, I spend so much of my time interviewing, talking to people, meeting people who sort of welcome me into their kind of worlds and describe what it's like to be them. I find that really difficult, the sort of conversational flow, the flow of a chat or an interview that was completely gone. I just wasn't picking up on things that normally I would have done. And situations which were difficult, which were more sort of acoustically challenging, like a pub or a restaurant or outside, I find really, really difficult. So instead of this lovely sort of flow of interaction with another person, there was now this just kind of series of sort of jolting, uncomfortable, difficult monologue. So I felt in front, you know, beside my peers, beside all my friends who were sort of, you know, they were all trying to do the right thing. They just didn't know how to respond. I felt very, you know, I felt a beat behind. I felt like kind of, you know, the last person in on the joke. I felt stupid. And that I find really, really difficult to deal with, I think.
Do you think... couple questions. I'm fascinated to know or interested to know if you feel as if this is this is a much, I would imagine this is a much different book that you've written, Sound, than if you had decided, you know, at the age of 26 to write a book on sound. I mean, you've got life experience, but this is a very specific kind of experience now that you're bringing to these observations, to your worldview, frankly. So I guess the question is, are you a better writer because of this? And are you a better human? I mean, is that a fair question?
Yeah, totally. I'm quite certainly a better human. Whether I'm a better writer or not, I don't know. I think there's no question that it gave me a depth and a... it just gave me another layer, I guess. But I mean, one of the things about that period, that 12-year period, was that print was a very comfortable place for me to run to. So I continued to write all the way through that. But the great thing about print is that it's always at the right volume. So actually, I was always writing. I was always communicating. I was always doing something. So I really can't tell. It wasn't like, you know, at the beginning of the 12 years, I stopped writing and then I picked it up again at the end of the 12 years. So there was a real marker. It's pretty seamless. You know, I published 3 or 4 books during that, more than that, I think, during that period. So it was, I can't see that, if you said. I can't pick up the difference. In terms of how I am as a human being, yes, unquestionably. I don't know how it changed me. I can't quantify how it changed me. I just know that it did, and it did for the better.
So how do we learn from that? So clearly someone can read the book and hopefully pay attention and make notes and have other conversations, and we trust let's put it on me. I trust now that I'm going to be a better listener as a result of this. I so love that you refer to this act of listening as something good and beautiful and true, and this act of communion. I mean, you've turned it into this. I don't know. I want to say ritual almost, but we need to focus our time and our effort, because really what we're doing is we're validating the other. We're saying to somebody else or this other group that you're included, you matter, you're a part of my community. How do I remind myself of that, having not had the experience that you've had?
I guess it's just, I mean, it's quite a difficult thing, because there is a lot of unwanted sound. There is a lot of unwanted input. So I guess it's also about prioritizing. You know, if a friend brings you up and, you know, what sounds like a kind of normal sort of catch up is obviously, you know, there's obviously something troubling them underneath, then that's really, really worth devoting kind of all your listening to. And the same for a family member. You know, it may be a conversation that you think you've had 1,000 times, but actually there's something underneath that. There's something that needs to be said. Of course, if you're having a conversation with somebody in a call center, both of you are in a kind of different mode. It's not going to be a great listening experience, however you play it.
Right.
But so I guess it's just, it's recognizing the moment when it makes all the difference in the world just to open yourself to be open to listening completely. And of course, and you know, you need to be careful with your resources and your energy and all the rest of it. So just recognizing when actually, and you do start to recognize when somebody wants to, you know, what they're transmitting is different to what they're broadcasting, if you see what I mean.
Mm.
So you get good at reading the signals, I guess.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I think it's a reminder, certainly, for me, you know, in the work that I do as a dad, as a husband, and so on, just as a friend. I think of being distracted in conversation recently, even with a couple of friends I hadn't seen in a while, for, you know, this sort of annual Christmas get-together, holiday meal and a few drinks, and over the shoulders is this wretched television. I don't even really watch sports, and there's a football and a hockey game on, and I keep looking up and getting getting distracted, you know? I mean, that's a whole other conversation, I suppose, and maybe I should have made a decision and said, guys, can I sit on the other side, you know? Can I sit with you? Can we move the move tables so I can focus a little more? But I think it really is a great reminder to put down the phone, to turn the phone over so that we can't even see the face of it. I mean, I think some of these simple things that we could do to become better listeners, certainly for myself, make a lot of sense.
Yeah, for sure, definitely, and I completely understand what you mean by the TV on in the background. I mean, we all seem to do it. We all seem to have. We're sort of multitasking with sound, so in any given situation, there's always the radio, there's always machinery, there's always, you know, the sound of the car, there's always kind of the phone pinging, there's kind of whatever it is, and actually that's not true listening, because you can only, almost by definition, be listening with half an ear, and you can't really be listening to what your friend's saying about where they're at.
On the cover of the book, can you tell me what that is? Is that it's a group of birds? Is that a perturbation? Is that what that's called?
It's called a murmuration.
Murmuration. Thank you.
The murmuration of starlings.
And clearly that. From a distance, that would have very little sound, but it would just be gorgeous and beautiful to watch. And I saw a small one on a drive just yesterday afternoon. But when they're large and you're up close, it's quite a different experience.
They're absolutely amazing. It's because you get them, particularly this time of year. Actually, you get them in certain places, and these kind of dense, thick, sort of masses, flocks. Shoals of birds all together, all starlings, and they ebb and flow in this incredibly beautiful way, almost as a sort of single organism, and they make the most extraordinary noise, because again the sound it sounds like a single organism, and it doesn't sound like individual birdsong. It sounds like this kind of electricity. It's just absolutely it's one of those sort of great phenomena. It's just a beautiful thing.
Yeah, speaking of poetry, so I love some of the people who appear in your book, and some of the people you've interviewed and you talk through, and Nine Inch Nails even makes an appearance, you know, speaking about interesting sounds, and you talk about I'm just trying to think of the phrase that you actually use around torture and around loud sounds and white noise. And I know what it is, and it wasn't your phrase, but I guess it was, you know, kind of something the military would use, enhanced interrogation, as if, you know, as if this makes it just a little bit better.
Yeah, well, I think they also call it white torture. And that I find really difficult to write about, because it's basically a form of torture that doesn't leave marks. It just leaves... You know, just ravages people psychologically, because what they do is to disrupt and disorientate through the senses, so extreme noise for 24 hours a day, so people can't sleep, waterboarding, all of that stuff. It's all stuff that doesn't leave a physical mark, but is nevertheless designed to wear the person down. And I found this guy in the UK who was prepared to talk to me about some of that. And, you know, that's a hard listen, because I now associate sound, you know, even if it's kind of, you know, stuff I don't particularly like, with joy and with all things kind of loveliness and the joy of that. And to hear it being twisted and used for these dark purposes is really difficult, and used to screw people up and to extract information from them. I understand that it may be necessary, but I also, I find that hard to.
I find it fascinating. I mean, I love the paradox of taking something beautiful and turning it into something, you know, challenging and difficult and maybe even bordering on evil in some cases. But I also find it fascinating that the people that you bring into this story, into, you know, into the book and into, you know, as you reflect on what it means to commune with others, you know, and to listen to what's going on around us. I find it fascinating. And also in this specific case, you know, it's not, you know, you would normally think of loud noise, you would think of death metal or loud rock and roll, Black Sabbath, I think you talk about Rage Against the Machine, but it's also Barney the Dinosaur or birds chirping. I mean, it's really interesting.
It is, and as I said, it's a really difficult one because, you know, any noise, it doesn't matter what it is, it could be bird song, it could be, you know, chainsaw, it could be, something taking off on the deck of an aircraft carrier. If it's loud enough, it will eventually damage hearing, and if it's relentless enough, it'll stop, you know, people from sleeping. It is a sensory overload, basically. And I guess if you're in the military, you are used to sound being associated with aggression, you know, sort of rocket launchers, rifles, guns, you know, explosions, very loud aircraft noises, and that sort of thing. So the leap from that to using sound as a bad thing isn't that great. I think it's, you know, for the rest of us, we all find it kind of much more difficult. But one of the things that was really interesting in the book, and I sort of did quite a lot about, was within both the military and the music industry, the levels of deafness, the levels of hearing loss are just, I mean, they're just catastrophic. I mean, I think one of the studies in the US was that more than half of army vets have really quite serious hearing loss. And you know, you're never going to get proper statistics on the degree of hearing loss within serving personnel because there's collusion on both sides and neither side really wants to report it, neither the soldiers nor the top brass. So, and the music industry, likewise, you know, if you stand really close to the speakers for a long, long time, it's not going to go great for your hearing. And, you know, it is damaging. A lot of, you know, the kind of older generation of rock stars and classical musicians have really damaged hearing, but they don't talk about it.
Yeah, no, there's a huge lesson to be learned there. Sadly, Bella, we've got to wrap it up here, but I just want to read a little portion of chapter 13, and I'd love for you to talk a little bit around Tony Parker and taxi drivers in a second here. Quote, "I wanted everything. I wanted to try everything, listen to everything. I wanted to go up to strangers in the street and ask them if they had any idea of the miracles taking place inside their heads. I wanted to tell them that this hearing thing, this basic feature, fitted totally a standard in every working model, turned out upon examination to be a piece of kit which made the works of Shakespeare seem slack by comparison," close quote. I mean, it's so lovely, so beautiful. Can you talk a little bit about this communion and maybe connect it to Tony Parker and taxi drivers?
Yeah, it was, I mean, one of the things that I sort of end the book by just describing this concert I went to with a friend where it was the first time I'd listened to music without these digital hearing aids, without any kind of filter, for the first time in 12, 13, whatever it was, 14 years, something like that. And it wasn't just an extraordinary, exceptional experience. It was a kind of full body, absolute. It changed my DNA. It changed my cell structure. It was so profound and extraordinary. It was just absolutely wonderful. And it did, I mean, that was music, but it sort of tied in very much with how I'd started out. So way back at school, I'd come across the writings of a guy called Tony Parker, who was a, an oral historian. He occupies a sort of space that in the US, I think, was sort of occupied by Studs Terkel, except Tony Parker didn't do radio. He just did these books, which were transcripts of interviews, and they were acts of listening. He was known as the Great Listener, and he was just a plainly, absolutely lovely man. He was a Quaker, a pacifist, and a prison visitor. And he would interview, you know, the people in Belfast during the Troubles, or soldiers, or lighthouse keepers, or the residents of an East End London housing estate, or kind of whatever. And he would draw them out and get them to tell their whole stories, and you know, in their words, with their phrasing, and they were just lovely. And they were they themselves were sort of minor sort of miracles of catching the fullness of a person. And I guess, yeah, I mean, both of them were, you know, both that amazing concert and Tony Parker's work were kind of, you know, the best kind of listening that you can possibly have, the best of all.
It's so good, and I think it's a beautiful way to end our conversation and interview today. And if people want to hear more about the taxi drivers as psychiatrists, I think, or psychologists, you know, it's they play an important role. They're going to need to pick up your book. The book is called Sound, A Memoir of Hearing, Lost and Found by Bella Bathurst. Bella, thanks so much for your time today, for sharing with us a little bit more about what was going on in your story, and thank you for a brilliant read and an important book that I hope everyone picks up and everyone reads.
Well, thank you so much.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.